Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news relating to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Transformational Mortgage Solutions. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here's your host of Lickin' on Lending, David Lickin.
Welcome, everybody. So good to have you here with us. Happy New Year. It's Monday, January 2nd, 2017. Welcome to the end of the new year. This podcast is created by mortgage professionals. It's for mortgage professionals, and we're the proud recipient of the Progress in Lending Innovation Award. Very grateful for that award. Very grateful to have you, our listeners, tuning in and listening to this podcast, especially on a holiday when so many people are taking the day off and enjoying some time with their family. With the holiday falling on Sunday, we're obviously getting the national holiday today. So many of you are enjoying this time, and we're so grateful to have you tuning in to be here with us. We are excited about today's podcast. We have Les Parker, who will be dialing in and joining us here hopefully shortly. He is Senior Vice President of Loan Logics, and will be giving us an economic update, and as he does each and every, at the beginning of each and every year. Now, several people have said, well, could you have Les on later, a little later on in the month? And I go, yeah, but this is, interestingly, one of the bigger listening times when people are off. More people listen to the podcast because they're relaxed. They can take time. They go, oh, yeah, we can get to listen to that. So we have a lot of people listening to the podcast today because it is a holiday. And we appreciate you taking time to join us. Again, a special thank you goes out to our sponsors, ArchMI, the creator of the new innovative RateStar program, Motivity Solutions, providing real-time reporting and dashboards and scorecards, also now part of the Black Knight Company. Also, we have Velma. We have which is the efficient mortgage marketing and email platform. Very excited to be a partner with them. They do a great job of getting the word out. Also, Simplify, a real-time electronic communications exchange, and also the Mortgage Collaborative, the power of the network. Very excited to be a part of them. And then, of course, D&H, D plus H. Call it D&H. And they move your world forward through technology. They have been in business for 140 years, 5,500 employees worldwide, 8,000 clients in 70 countries. Many companies can claim that one. And they encourage you to check out what they're doing with their mortgage product. They also have a mobile app. What looks like a mobile app, it's really an all-in-one LOS system, and they have it mobile-ready. Very effective, very innovative. Check it out. And you can, of course, check it all out at dh.com. Two letters, dh.com, or call them at 1-800-815-5592. Again, so thrilled to have you with us and be a part of the podcast. Normally, we'd be having Alice, Andy, and Joe, and Paul. Sam's in here. He's working today. He's in the office. At least he's joining us. But Alice, Andy, Joe, and Paul will not be here joining us today. So it's really, really grateful to have them in the mix. Let's see here. There's everybody in the mix normally. They're not going to be in the mix today or on the program today, but we wish all of them a very happy new year. Got some people dialing in the last minute. Les just joined us. So excited about having him in here. Let's see here. Talk about upcoming MBA conferences, January 23rd through the 26th, the Independent Mortgage Banking Conference. I'll be speaking at that, doing a panel discussion on efficiencies and how to create greater efficiencies and profits for your company. Very important topic in the new year. I think many companies are going to be known more for their process than their products. Products are pretty boring, so we're talking about what you can do to differentiate yourself through your processes and becoming more efficient. And I'm very excited to have that topic and be honored to be not only chairing that, but moderating it and organizing and speaking at it, bringing together Alice Alvey will be joining me there. We have Bill Cosgrove, the founder of this Independent Mortgage Bankers Conference, joining us, as well as Aaron D, who will be joining us. She has been a guest on the radio program. Very excited about that. Also, the National Mortgage Servicing Conference is coming up in Gaylord, Texas, at the Gaylord Texan in Grapevine, Texas. And also March 1st through the 4th, we have the Mortgage Collaborative Winter Conference. By the way, also check out the TMBA, Texas Mortgage Bankers Association, secondary conference taking place. I think it's the 30th, 31st, and the 1st. I'm speaking at that. I'm the opening speaker for the conference on Monday, and I believe that is on the 31st. So get those dates out. I'll have more specifics when we get back after the break. But anyway, check these conferences out. Look forward to seeing you there. And then also a host of other conferences throughout the year. Now, Joe Farr would normally be here. The markets, we're going to get a market update from Les Parker here a little bit later in the podcast. Looking forward to having him here on that. Excuse me. But also want to say a special thank you to Joe Farr for the job he does at MBS Quote Line. And we're going to take a quick break for a couple of ads that we have here. And I just want to be back. Also, Merry Christmas to and Happy New Year to Paul Mallo. I just noticed he is not joining us today. So it's good to have you all with us. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to be right back after this brief word. Are you using one of those expensive CRMs that your loan officers won't use? If so, then give my friends at Velma a call and let them help you create a customer journey that relies on the data and not on loan officer interaction. I encourage you to consider working with Velma to create a truly automated marketing experience for your organization. Velma makes marketing automation easy. Schedule a demo today at Velma.com, V-E-L-M-A.com.
Simplifile has technology that gives you the ability to collaborate with settlement agents via real-time chat and messaging, allowing you to track changes, send, receive, and validate documents, as well as obtain status updates and deal with issues as they arise. All of this in a real-time electronic communication exchange. And best of all, you have a complete audit trail of all communications. To learn more, go to simplifile.com or call our good friend Nancy Alley at 1-800-460-5657.
So good to have our sponsors. Grateful for them. Also grateful for our regulars, Paul Mallo, of course, Joe Farr, Alice Alvey. Alice is also on vacation this week, enjoying her time, as I hope she is. But we do have Sam Garcia, who dialed in to join us. Sam, good to have you on the podcast, my friend. How are you doing? Whoops. You know what? It would help if I turned on. You know, you take 1 week off and do the podcast, Sam, you forget little things like, oh, yeah, turn on the button, turn on the mic. So anyway, Sam, Happy New Year. Sorry about that, my friend.
Yeah, I don't want to take credit for working too hard today. I know you said I'm working today, but, you know, just a few things. I'm taking it easy. So, but I just noticed
you.
I'm looking in our files here. It's my fourth year doing this with you. I don't know how where the time went.
4 years? Has it already been 4 years? How time flies when you're having fun, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So we actually did put out a story for tomorrow already. This is based on data we got from EMBS, and that indicated that the issuance of fixed-rate mortgage-backed securities on behalf of Fannie, Freddie, and Ginnie came to $157 billion during December. And while activity was, you know, hardly changed at Freddie and Ginnie from the prior month, over at Fannie Mae, issuance soared by more than half to $71 billion. So issuers of Fannie Mae, I guess, just took advantage of getting this last month in. And, of course, we can expect that we're going to see a sharp decline in monthly issuance over 2017 as, you know, there's a lot less originations that are expected as a result of rising rates. But for all of 2016, fixed-rate issuance on behalf of the agencies came to $1.451 trillion. That was up from a little over $1.2 trillion in 2015. And it turned out to be the strongest year since 2013 when it was about $1.5 trillion in MBS was issued on behalf of Fannie, Freddie, and Ginnie. So they basically, because of Fannie, finished the year off pretty damn strong.
Yeah.
Fannie put out its monthly summary for November, and it said that single-family delinquency was 1.23%. That's 90-day delinquency. So that turned out to be 2 basis points higher than in October, and it was the first time that delinquency increased at Fannie since February 2010. So they'd been on a pretty strong decline each month for that many years, actually, with delinquency. But let's put it in perspective. The latest rate that I just told you is still the second lowest rate on record since March 2008. So I think it just got to a point where you can't really go a whole lot lower on the rate. But always good to see that they've maintained this low rate, and that means loan performance is good. the CFPB released its monthly report on complaints, and for the 3 months that ended on November 30th, the monthly average for overall financial services complaints was up 13% from a year earlier, and that's significant because when you look at just mortgage complaints, they were down 2% during that same period. So mortgage companies are doing a better job than overall financial service companies, at least when it comes to complaints that are being filed on behalf of them. The most recent one came out to 4,200 a month for mortgages. So, you know, again, lenders are doing a good job. Actually, I say lenders, it's servicers too. So complaints are filed probably even more with against servicers or about servicing than they are with production. Thanks to the holidays and sharply higher interest rates, our mortgage market index fell to the lowest level on record last week since we launched it in late 2009. The report, which is based on rate lock activity at open close, indicated that ARM activity took the biggest hit, falling 35%. One thing I like to note, though, of course, we don't apply seasonal adjustments, so we're going to see bigger declines and rises during, these holiday and post-holiday weeks. But still, compared to any other holiday week that since we've been doing this, it was the worst one yet. So,
interesting.
Yeah, yeah. The parent of United Wholesale, which is United Shore, agreed to settle False Claims Act violations allegations. That settlement, of course, is tied to FHA lending. We've seen a lot of those kind of settlements lately. And it'll cost United Shore $48 million. That's a significant hit there. And United Wholesale, of course, claims to be the biggest wholesaler out there. We put out a Wire news story last week, and it indicated that the former George W. Bush administration HUD secretary, Alfonso Jackson, says that Ben Carson, who's, of course, President-elect Donald Trump's choice to lead HUD, is a strong fit for HUD secretary. And his comments a lot of people question, Carson doesn't really have the experience to run the housing agency, but here's a guy who did, and, he says he's a good fit. So
that's good.
PHH last week, they made a filing with the SEC disclosing plans to sell all of their MSRs. Those MSRs are tied to $72 billion in mortgages, and the buyer on that deal is New Residential Mortgage. PHH said that a subservicing agreement with New Residential has it subservicing 480,000 loans on the underlying MSRs, or that are underlying the MSRs, and that's going to be for a period of at least 3 years. But just another step forward with PHH kind of just, I don't want to say getting out of the business, but certainly reducing their operations when it comes to mortgages. And, of course, they used to have a whole lot of businesses and then ultimately wound up with just the mortgage piece of it.
Right.
I went through before I got on the phone here with you and just kind of looked through our traffic reports. And here are some of the biggest stories of the year, since this is really the year end or year beginning, whichever way you want to look at it, show that you've got going.
Yeah.
What I thought was interesting is one of our most read stories was that Mitch Kidder's comments that he made on your show.
Yeah.
We did a story about that, about PHH versus the CFPB lawsuit. So, kudos to you for having a topic that was just so popular that even the story we covered about it, wound up being one of our biggest stories of the year.
It blew up our phone lines here on our side for sure.
Yeah, it was good. It was really good. You did well. Another one that did really well this year for us was the story about the Wells Fargo settlement over fraudulently creating 2 million accounts. That was, that turned out to be the biggest CFPB settlement on record. Over 5,000 employees were fired, and it ultimately led to the, ouster of chairman and CEO. So that was a pretty big deal, and it didn't even really involve so much the mortgage side of it, though it did, ultimately lead to them not having referrals from one side to another when it comes to mortgages. Another big story for us this last year was a former executive over at SunTrust Mortgage. His wife and his two brother-in-laws were convicted for running a mortgage fraud scheme. So that's something, something you don't see too often. But SunTrust obviously is a big company, but they weren't implicated at all. Just the former executive. And another big story we had was a former FDIC attorney was sentenced to prison for mortgage fraud that she committed against Wells Fargo.
What?
Kind of rare. Yeah, isn't that crazy?
An FDIC employee.
A what former FDIC attorney.
Attorney? Oh,
yes,
that's interesting.
And one other one
That. Yeah, just other than just tragic. I hate to see these kind of things.
You know, when you have this many people in an industry, it could be everybody could be mostly good, but still there's always going to be a few players. What are you going to do? Of course, you know, mortgage fraud hasn't been as much of a problem lately because, A, underwriting is a lot tougher, and, B, there's a lot of services out there that help mortgage companies identify when there's potential of fraud. So that has just been they've really brought it down quite a bit, you know, when you compare it to pre-crisis. And, gosh, you know, I don't know if I ever told you, but mortgage fraud was really what got us going here, I don't know, in the early 2000s. We were doing a lot of mortgage fraud coverage kind of before it really was even close to being an issue. And there came a point where they were interviewing me actually on September 11th, 2001. It was Newsweek magazine about our coverage of mortgage fraud. And, of course, that story never made it to Newsweek. There were far more important issues to cover for quite a while after that. But, that was that used to be such a big deal. And now fraud is just, you know, not as rampant and certainly not as much of a factor as it has been, especially pre-crisis. But the other one story that came up that was read quite a bit was the W.J. Bradley Mortgage Capital story, where they announced in March plans to close down. And yeah, there were 500 people, I think, at that point, roughly working there. But they've been around for years, so that was a big story. And, you know, always sad to lose somebody, but, you know, it's capitalism. The best continue on and the weakest go by the wayside. You still there, Dave? Okay. All right. Well, listen, it's been good to be on the show here. I hope you get your microphone back.
I got you back there. Yeah. Sorry about that. I had to unmute one line and turn on another on mic. Something went wrong with that one. So anyway, sorry about that. But anyway, yes, thank you very much for filling in. You did a good job, like a pro. So it's really good. Appreciate it. Looking forward to getting your analysis as we go through into the new year. Lots of good stuff. And for those that have not checked out your website, I encourage them to do so. You can go to MortgageDaily.com or email SamGarcia@MortgageDaily.com or call them at 214-521-1300. Sam, really appreciate you being here, friend.
Thank you, sir.
You bet. All right, folks, we are going to take a quick break. Look at the mic situation here. We've got Les Parker coming up right after these couple brief words from our sponsors, but we'll be back in just a few minutes. Let's start off by talking to Jim Jump over there at Arch MI. Very grateful to have the relationship with them. And so, Jim Jump, tell us about the RateStar app.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me on, and we're happy to be a proud sponsor of the program. And today I'd like again to talk about RateStar from Arch Mortgage Insurance. RateStar is a revolutionary tool that allows mortgage originators to dynamically price mortgage insurance and match coverage to ArchMI's most competitive rates. And that's important because it allows you to compete more effectively, qualify more borrowers, and of course, close more loans. That's the power of RateStar. Originators from around the country are letting us know just how quick and easy RateStar is to use. And all you need is your NMLS number, and you can access RateStar anywhere, anytime, using multiple points of entry, including most LOS systems, product and pricing engines, and through our websites at archmi.com and archmicu.com for credit unions. And of course, it's available through our mobile app for smartphones and tablets. RateStar makes it easy to choose what type of mortgage insurance coverage your loan needs. You just touch, tap, and go. Quotes are delivered in seconds and represent our most competitive ArchMI rates based on the strength and quality of the loan application. And I have to tell you, David, getting a mortgage insurance quote has never been so powerful or so simple. And with that, I'll turn it back over to you and say thanks. Have a great day, everybody.
We appreciate you being here with us, Jim. Wish you and everyone there at Arch MI a very happy new year. Without further ado, let's get our guest on today, our special guest, Les Parker. Les, I know you're dialing in on your holiday, and I want to say a big thank you to you for taking the time out to share with us and many of our listeners who are dialed in, or excuse me, are logged in on the line and to listen to us. So appreciate it so much.
It's always a joy to be with you, David.
I appreciate it. For those that do not know you, you are Senior Vice President of Loan Logics, and there's many products you have, and your company continues to grow and prosper. So I know we're going to talk about economics, but just ahead of that, let's talk a little bit about some of the exciting things going on at Loan Logics, and I'd love to have you respond to the question of, do you see fraud going up or going down? I'd love to get you weighing in on that before we get into the topic of forecasting.
You know, it's really exciting what we're doing at Loan Logics these days. It's been quite a change over the last three and a half years in Loan Logics life. And before that, we had Nilex and Aclaro that had been around for a number of years. And Nilex, one of the leading product pricing engines in the U.S., and then we also had Aclaro, which did great work on quality, quality control, quality assurance, doing the quality control audits. And now joined together, it's been a wonderful journey for our customers. They now are seeing ways to improve their workflows, having a higher throughput on underwriting, higher throughput on if they do internal quality controls. They're seeing, which means they're getting good ROIs in the investments in dealing with Loan Logics. So we, the main reason we're in business is to serve our customers and have happy customers. And they are giving us the feedback we need to be a continuously improving company. And it's been very exciting. We are still doing quality control assurance, you might say, the front end where we do pre-closing audits. We're providing workflow items to where people can increase the efficiencies of their underwriters. We're providing post-closing reviews, but also empowering customers to do their own post-closing reviews so that they can then increase the number of files that they do per person per day. It's just a lot of things happening. We're really moving forward in 2017 with how can we really transform this business even more. It's been great that we've been able to provide anywhere from 25% to 75% improvements in throughput. And it's, you know, picking up productivity is great, right? And it improves everybody's bottom lines. It makes happier customers. It's their customers can be happier because they're more, the lenders are more efficient in the way they do things. But what about how the total fits? How does it, how do we have make sure there's quality from day one and that all the way to the time a loan pays off? How do we assure that? How do we make sure we have higher customer satisfaction? Not the lenders I'm talking about, the borrowers. How do we have it so the whole industry provides better quality to all customers so customers are happy? This industry still does not really have great customer ratings. There are spots, obviously, with certain lenders and all handling customers well at certain time periods, but not from the cradle to grave, not from the first the locking of the loan all the way the loan's paid off. Customers consistently have hiccups throughout that whole process, whether it's in the origination process, whether it's the selling of the loan, the boarding of the loan and servicing, whether it's the handling of the loan during the servicing process, the way it's handled when it's paid off, is still plenty of handoffs and disconnects. What we are trying to do, and we are addressing all of these high contact areas where consumers are interacting with lenders and lenders are interacting with the secondary marketing system. We are working on the plumbing for all of those items so that all of those items we can see not just some improvement of 10% or 5% improvement. We're talking about leaps and bounds improvement so that the whole industry can really see transformative activity. And that's why I like the name of your company. transformative.
Transformational mortgage. The transformational mortgage. That's why I love the partnership with you guys. You guys are all about transforming, making a huge impact in the industry, and you're doing a great job of it. And one of the things you do a great job that our listeners love is your input and forecasts. And you have become widely read. You used to have a company called Parker & Associates, and before you joined forces there with LoanLogix, they bought your company, if I recall. But you've been doing a great job of forecasting for decades. And for many who do not know, when someone's hedge would go awry and they were wondering, do we have the right person doing hedging, they brought you in because you're kind of recognized as one of the top industry professionals who can discern whether or not someone's hedge is working or if they're doing appropriate, you know, best practices in their hedging business. So I know several of my friends have brought you in to help comment about that, so or look at and opine to their best practices. So it's good to have you with us. And,
thank you.
You know, I think a good way to start off, I can't wait to talk about Trump, but before we go there into the, as we many are saying, the Trump question.
No, we're going to talk about Trump?
I can't imagine that.
Is there any name that gets more recognition on Facebook, on Twitter, you name the social media? Is there anybody that's getting more tweets? It's unbelievable.
It is a phenomenon.
My wife, I would turn on any of the cable stations, and I would just go Trump, because it was that's all it was.
It's been amazing how he has dominated. It is just really astounding, the election all the way through. But let's take a look through the rearview mirror. If you do a brief review of 2016, and if you wouldn't mind sharing it from, I want this one of the things I like about you is transparency is, you know, what you thought, what you expected, and what was realized, and it's the projected versus actuals as we do in budgeting oftentimes. So tell us about what you projected and how it came out, how it turned out.
Well, you know, I appreciate that, and I do try to. I was reading one of the leading analysts in the United States, actually globally, to wealth funds, and as he was commenting about, you know, we share our forecast, but we also tell you how it actually was going to perform, actually perform. And I think it's important that we do things like that. So just going back a few years to give people a census, particularly since your audience has been growing a lot over these last number of years. And the way, I do want to say, Dave, it is what a dedication you have to bringing this service to all of us in the mortgage industry. There's representatives in Congress and in state legislatures that are listening to you and to your guests, and your listeners are giving you feedback. So your listeners are also having an influence on how this game, how the mortgage business is going to be shaped by legislation. So it's really important what you're doing, and
thank you.
I've known you for many years. It's a tough job, but I'm glad you're doing it.
It's a labor of love. Passion thank you for those kind comments. That really means a lot.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
I'll give people a little bit of a real quick rundown. So I try to provide a forecast of where I think the range of rates will be in the 10-year. So I keep my outlook, it's more an outlook, is to try and get a sense of what's going to be the high and lows of the year. I'll give people a sense of where I think it's actually going to go, but I want to first say, bind it by, here's where the high should be and here's where the low is, if it's a normal or relatively calm environment. And then if things get a little wild, what should it be on the outside? So I provide those two numbers every year, or four numbers, you should say. So the expected range and then the outside range. And so when I'm reviewing, I'm looking at it in that context, I'm not to try and forecast what will rates be on December 31st, 2017. That's like trying to call what will the Dow be on the last day of trading. I know people do it for fun, but in reality, that doesn't really help us. So I think understanding where the range is and where it could possibly go, that's helpful, because if volatility is low, then you have a sense of what your productivity or what your origination should be. If it's somewhat wide, that's also going to have an impact. So here's the review before I give you the real bad news, unfortunately, for our industry in 2017. I give a sneak preview. If anybody knows their history, think 2000 or think 1994. But anyway, we'll get to that later. So in 2011, so it's going back a ways, we were expecting 3.8 to 1.8 in the 2 year, 200 basis points range. The market was 3.77 and 1.72 for 195 basis points. In 2012, we thought it would be 2.5 to 1.5, a nice round 100 basis points. It turned out to be 2.39 and 1.38 for 101 basis points. So we nailed the range, and we were off by 10 beeps up on both sides there. So on the following year, 2013, 3 to 1.6, and the 1.6 was our extreme because we did think we were going to get extreme. We did get an extreme that year for 140 basis points. What actually happened was 2.99, and it was 1.61 for 138 basis points. So we published these numbers, so it's not like I went back and –
Yeah, I mean, you could change them. Exactly right.
I'm amazed at 2013. I mean, that's pretty amazing to be only off one basis point. So 2014, we thought it would get a little bump. And this was the year, by the way, that at least all the major IBs, that's investment bankers, thought rates were going to be significantly higher. We were looking at 3.2 as being the high end. And the low end with the outside low end, because we did think we'd go to outside, would be 1.9. The industry was looking at over 4 to, or higher on the 10-year for that year. And we were starting off right at 3. And so they thought it would go up 4 to 4%. And we basically felt we were already topped out. But I did put in 3.2 to 1.9. It turned out to be 3.04. to 1.87. Wow. So on the downside, 1.9, 1.87. And by the way, those are intraday, if anyone's asking. I'm not looking at the closing. I was looking at intraday.
Yeah, so you're saying intraday, we didn't blow through any of these ceilings or any of these floors that, for the most part, with exception of 2013, just one
yeah, tenth, in 2014, we blew through it by 3 beats. So
in
2015... 2015 was a tough year for me. I thought we'd be at a 2.9 to 1.35. I thought volatility was going to start picking up some. This was the expected range, and that would have been 155 basis points. We got about half that. So we did go up to 2.5, and then we stayed to 1.64. Now, what happened in 2015 was very simple. The Fed said they were going to start tightening in early 2015. They were sending signals already. Many people thought the green shoots of the economy that the Fed would be tightening in March or the summer of that year of 2015, and it didn't happen. They didn't tighten until the end of 2015. So the reason we had such a narrow range was basically the market holding its breath because of the Federal Reserve. So 2016, essentially I did the same forecast. I just adjusted it slightly, and I said 2.8 to 1.4 for 140 basis points range, and it turned out to be 2.64, which we just hit on December 15th, and that the low was 1.32 for a range of 132 basis points. So we were pretty much right on this year, last year, 2016.
Yeah, last year, 16, yep.
And it's because the Fed finally started, people were gaining some confidence that they actually were going to do what they're going to do. And some would say, wow, so you thought 2.8 and we were under that and we had the Trump bump at the end, didn't we? Yes. So,
yeah. Yes.
I don't know if you want to ask me about the Trump bump yet or about Russia, but I can first give you why I thought 2016.
Well, let's go there. You opened it up. Let's go ahead. Yeah, let's go there. Let's go right into it because I think it – and then I can't wait for the 17, what you're predicting on that. Or should we do that and then come back and cover that later? You've got these so well organized on here, and I don't want to break you from your logic. Or are you going to keep us in suspense until the end for the 217?
Well, you know what? No, I want to do – we'll let the suspense hang there just a little bit. Hopefully we'll wrap this up a little early for your listeners. But I wanted to – why don't we first go into, I know we were talking about why did 2016 happen? Because some people are looking at it, but the Trump bump, and what about that? And yet you stayed actually in a slightly quieter range than you were expecting, though. I mean, 140 versus 132 on the range of rates is pretty much right on.
Right.
So what happened? I think let's first set why we didn't do what I thought we were going to, even though that was my expected range. I thought 2016 was finally going to break out and have the outside ranges be hit on both ends, but it didn't happen.
Right.
So why did it? We stayed in a little wider range than the previous year. That makes sense. So the expected happened. Well, the expected happened because the Fed didn't happen. So.
Right.
So what I thought the outside ranges would be hit if the Fed actually started tightening through the year, but they were losing followers, you might say. The Federal Reserve has been losing confidence with investors. So the investors are kind of wondering, what are you really doing? And so they're not really buying now. They're we're going to tighten talk because. The beginning of 2016, they said they were going to tighten four times. Then they said, well, no, excuse me, we're going to do it only three times. And then they went to two times. They said, well, I'm sure we're going to do something by the end of the year. And this is in October. And some people thought were in September. And they thought, okay, well, then they'll do it in November. Or no, they won't, the election, they'll do it in October. No, of course not. And then they went ahead and they finally did at the end of December, which most of us felt they would do at least one, and they did at the end of the year. So let me give you two reasons why I thought it didn't happen. First is the Federal Reserve. Their open market took all of that accommodation. I've talked to you about that.
Right.
So they're really, the Federal Reserve last year and still this year is still accommodated. We're still at very low rates. They still are buying all of the runoff that comes from their mortgage portfolio,
right,
which they are the big player in the mortgage
market. That was going to be one of my questions.
They're a big player in the mortgage market. So they keep buying things. So they really are accommodated.
Extremely, so very accommodating.
Right. So I want to – one little tease for the forecast. What do you think has been the highest yield? What was the day? I said it earlier, but I wonder if your audience will remember. What did I say earlier? What was the high yield for this year? It was on December 15th.
Right.
So what happened on December 14th? December 14th is when the Fed actually tightened. So from that point on, because it's 2.64 is what that high yield was. Well, what do you think the yield is right now in the 10-year? The yield right now as we speak that's trading. Well, it's not really trading, but it was 2.44. So we are 20 basis points off of the high since December 15th. Why? Because the Federal Reserve tightened. But wait a minute. I thought every talking head in the media says that, well, as soon as the Fed starts tightening, then we're going to see higher rates. Well, then why don't we go back to December 2015? What were all the talking heads saying then? They said, well, the Fed's going to tighten. So, therefore, what will happen to mortgage rates? They'll go up.
Well,
of course.
That's
what
everybody
thought. But we didn't. Yep. We went down. So, you know, this is the same thing's going to happen this time because the historic items are still there. The Fed is tightening. That's true. That is going to cause the short end to go higher. That's true. It should. But what that'll end up with is you'll have a flatter yield curve. So before I get – that's a tease. That's just a tease. Let's just go ahead and go on to what happened. What was the other caveat in this market? Well, we had one other thing is what I've been looking for and why I've been so bullish for so many years, 30 years, except for 2000, or 1994, and then also I think it's 2001. We had another year in there that was pretty bearish. But so what am I waiting for? Why do I keep saying this? Well, one is that we didn't get, that's why we didn't get the extremes. We got some of it, but not all of it. And that is what I've been calling the great repricing. And all that means is that assets that investors are interested in buying that are riskier assets, so we call that risk on, when investors are interested in buying riskier assets as risk on. Why we need to get those assets to be cheaper. So we have to have a lower cost basis for those investors. Now, how do you get to a low? I'll ask the question. How do we get to a lower cost basis, Dave?
Yeah.
I mean, we can get to lower cost basis through a number of ways, right? How could we get your house, if you were trying to sell, how would we get your house to
flood
a lower cost basis? Okay, sure.
Flood the market with inventory?
Exactly. So we could have inventory sales, right? You could have, how else could maybe your house physically, if you, we had to sell it tomorrow.
Anything,
what
it'd be anything
do,
that distresses
it. Right?
Anything that gets into a distressed market. Yep.
Correct.
Any of the distress features. Correct.
Exactly.
So talk about that. Are you saying
we're bankruptcies, debt forgiveness, distress sales, and also in a global market, the other distress item is devaluations of currencies.
Right.
Because the devaluation of a currency means your country goes on sale. So think about Brexit. How many people out there in your listening audience have heard about Brexit? Now, Brexit was the Brits are saying we're going to leave the EU, the European Commonwealth, the European Union. We're going to leave the EU, not the EMU, because they never went into the euro, but into the EU, the common market. So they had never been as part of the EMU, which is the Economic Monetary Union, when that's what means the euro. So they never used the euro. They had the British pound. Well, what happened to the British pound? The British pound lost in one single day 10% of its value. What does that mean? That means a U.S. dollar could buy 10% of anything. Doesn't matter what it is. So if a house was on sale for 500,000 pounds in the outskirts of London, and the dollar, we'll just say it was we'll just say make up a number. I could have bought it in dollars for $600,000. Now I can buy it for $550,000 because the pound has lost 10%. In just
moment. We saw that kind of shift.
Correct. In just one day. And then over, a few weeks, it was down 15-20%. And if you went to extreme high on the pound and you went down to its low, over the extreme high was a couple of years ago, and now where it is, 25% discount. So devaluation of a currency means essentially a country is going on sale to other investors. It's going on sale to people of other currencies. If you compare the other currency to the British pound. So in the case of the dollar, it was a 10% decline in that day. So that's a repricing of an asset. So when the Brazil went through its great repricing a couple of years ago, 2014, its country went on sale, and when the Russians went into their recession, their country went on sale. When the baht recently had a significant change in its value, that's for Thailand, the country went on sale. So when Australia, that's now currently having problems and its currency is falling, then what does that mean? That means that country's on sale for other investors, foreign investors. The more that these countries worldwide are basically wanting to devalue their currency, it's another way of putting their country on sale. And by the way, it's very deceitful to do that because it undermines the purchasing power of every person that lives in that country.
And it lives in that country, exactly right.
Yeah.
That's right. So if so, now let's look at it from the Brits' viewpoint. When the Brexit happened and their currency dropped 10%, the American could come in there instead of not being it. Now they have a $50,000 benefit, right, for that half
right.
million in pounds and $600,000 in dollars. Just again, the, I didn't do the exact ratio change, but giving you a sense of it.
Right.
But what happened to the Brits that were there? Well, they now, what would the price be? The price would still be 500 pounds. So
yep.
that seems,
to
oh,
them.
There's no effect. However, what does happen as a currency declines, it causes assets to have, they will reprice upwardly. Follow me. So if the currency declines, what happens is inflation is a natural output of a currency's
exactly right.
decline. The further a currency drops, the more inflation is going to start popping up in an area. So what does that mean? If that means if your wages aren't – how quickly do wages respond to inflation? There's a delay, isn't there? In fact,
right.
it could maybe be – are you? How often do you get changes in your payroll? Once a year? Twice a year?
But unless
you know.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it's not that often.
So is there going to be a race to the bottom? One of the questions that one of our listeners is writing and saying, ask less, are do we seeing a race to the bottom on the currency in the currency war, or would you characterize it as that? In other words, just start devaluing things to the point where we've seen what China's doing. What's your thoughts on currency, foreign currencies, generally
devaluation,
speaking?
Devaluation, absolutely. And that's
yeah.
what I'm actually talking about. I think that assets still are
to
too
bottom.
Expensive, and you get
uh-huh.
a rate. It's been going on for a while. If you look at
right.
the emerging markets, you'll see how some of them have actually had an okay year in 2015 because of the dithering of the Fed, which
mm-hmm.
meant that the dollar was kind of languishing. But then the dollar finally started getting going as it realized what was happening globally. Let me put up the dollar chart here. I wish you could have it. It's a little more interactive for your listeners. But looking at the dollar chart in the middle of 2016, we kind of bottomed out. Then we started really rallying. The dollar is a basket of currencies dominated by the euro, the Swiss franc, and by the British pound. So when those three started really getting hurt, but particularly the British pound and the euro, then we started seeing the dollar really taking off. Also, the yen is, by the way, in that basket. There's some others. But the big thing is those. I do believe that currencies are generally, in 2017, it's going to be another round of race to the bottom. So you're going to see a lot lower currencies, but not the U.S. dollar. Because
not
the
dollar, yeah,
is,
exactly.
is the reserve currency. It is the reserve currency. There's numerous reserve currencies that can be used, even the yuan, the Chinese yuan is part of that. But that's not
right.
the reserve currency. 80 to 90% of all global transactions are done in the dollar.
The petrodollar, too. I mean,
that's right.
Yeah.
It's dollars. It's U.S. dollars.
Yeah. All oil, for the listeners that do not know this, all oil is traded in U.S. dollars. That's why it is the petrodollar. And now there's some talk about that changing because we look at the amount of gold that China has been buying up from many of the other countries. And so, I mean, we could go into all of that, but relate
yep.
this back to what this means for the average mortgage banker that is trying to figure out what to do with their business. Does the rising dollar, the falling currencies overseas have a direct impact to us? Does it really, and if so, how should people start planning their businesses for 2017?
I'm glad you asked that question. So some of them need to make sure they have a good bankruptcy lawyer on their Rolodex, on their iPhone. 2017, before we get to our Trump question.
I want to
give you the official final forecast. It's going to be, sadly, for mortgage bankers, a very bad year. And it's not going to be a bad year
volatility,
of significant – that's right, volatility.
Yeah, okay. So that's what – I'm sorry, I didn't mean to – you were going to the answer and as I was asking the question.
Okay.
So it's volatility that is going to be – but, Les, all these hedge firms are out there operating and doing supposedly the job managing that risk. And I've been deeply concerned, not because of the lack of sincerity or the ability for these guys to manage this risk, but I just don't sense that lenders, people that I know very well, they're just trusting to a point of blind trust. And I am concerned that they're not doing the analysis of the hedge or even understand it, much less are being proactive at managing it.
Well, how many times has the interest rate range of the 2-year been more than 200 basis points during a year over the last 30 years?
Wow.
Four times.
Four times?
I believe
no,
it's
I was
four
say,
times.
Not much. I was trying to
so
rack up.
I'm looking at 2008 was one.
Right.
2000 was just shy of two. 1994 was over two. 1995 was over two. So those are the main, and there was one more big mover in that 1987. That would be 30. That was, so I'm kind of going, not counting that one, and going forward, there was only one, and we'll get even in the ones that are close, about two, three, four times that we were that. 2011 was right at that, and 2008. So 2011, 2008, 2000 was just shy of it, and then we had 1994 and 1995.
Right.
So there's not been a lot of instances for over 200 basis points move in the 10-year. I've been thinking that for the last few years, I thought we had some chance to get there in 2014, 15, and 16.
Right.
You have to also look at the expected range. So the expected range, if some of the bad things that I expect to happen don't happen, we're still going to be somewhat calm, but comparable to last year in terms of the range. However, I don't think it's going to be a calm year. And the reason I don't think it's going to be calm is the Federal Reserve's continuing to tighten. They are going to continue to tighten.
Right.
And they've lost.
Do you think it'll be three times this year? Do you think we'll see three times, as they've said?
I think it's fair to think that we're going to see more than one. I don't think they're going to do the same game that they did this last year. Yellen is a dove at heart, I think she's going to view the Trump policies as more pro-growth policies, and so she's going to have a tendency to go ahead and try to stay somewhat ahead of the curve. I don't think they're going to be far enough ahead of the curve. That's why I think the second half of the year is going to be a disastrous year. But the first half of the year, I do still think the first quarter is going to see significantly lower rates. And that's going to give a little bit of a boost, a mini refi boom, because I think a lot of lenders are going to say, hey, we have our one last shot. I think borrowers are going to think they have the one last shot. They're going to see these declining rates. It's going to get a lot of loan officers really motivated to get out there and get theirs refis that have been kind of sitting on the fence. Some of those that had gotten at some of the higher rates that we had, like in 2011 and in 2010, maybe some of those now they could move into some more refis. So we won't have the huge drag. The MBA is forecasting for refis to be 30% of the market in 2017. I believe the first – it's going to be front-loaded, though. I think where the most of the refis are going to occur in the first quarter, maybe spill into the second quarter. But the third and fourth quarters, I think we could see refis be 5 to 10% of the total production. So if we see
– as little as
that, decline,
wow.
Because it will be significantly higher rates. So if the EM countries do in fact see some devaluation early on this quarter, that's going to put a lot of countries more on sale. The dollar will continue to get some more of its appreciation. I still think we can get to 105 to 110 on the dollar index, and we're call it 103 right now. So we're going to see this stronger dollar index. We're at 102.5 right now on the 0.4 in the.
And where
dollar
do you see
index.
It going? By year end?
I think we can be to 105 to 110. That's the range I've been wanting to see the dollar get to, and we keep not getting there, and partly because the Fed's been afraid to take a strong dollar policy. We need a strong dollar policy to cleanse the world of its debt. That's going to spark bankruptcies. It's going to spark just sales. It's distress sales. We need that. That's what you need to get a vibrant market. If you look at what happened with housing market and it crashed in California, the immediate response before the federal government or the state government got involved with trying to reduce foreclosures, there was a significant requisition that happened right away that was healthy for the market. Then you got a lot of government intervention, and the government intervention really stretched this thing out. And we've been kind of the good thing is we had lower volatility. We had just kind of stable times. We were able to get some of the weak people out of the market early on in the early crisis. But now it's, if you really want to bring long-term health, restore the secondary market, restore the PLS market, restore international commerce so that people can get out of this below 3% GDP in the G7 or G10 right, and get us back up above 3% growth in developed countries, but particularly in the United States, then we have to see a purging in the world of assets being repriced.
So
and I think we'll have it in Q1 and Q2.
So do you think it will happen in Q1, Q2? And are you talking about sovereign bankruptcies, basically?
No, not looking. I'm looking just at, large mining companies in Mongolia.
Okay.
Or, you know, things that happening in Australia.
Okay.
I mentioned Mongolia on purpose because Mongolia is one that saw a great rise because of its resources being bought by China. But now I think that's going to be a challenge because I think challenges are going to be facing China in 2017. Some of those things that have been lingering are going to finally hit even more in 2017, and sadly, it's because of one major event. There was one major event that happened in 2016, almost dwarfs what happened with the election of Donald Trump, and that was that the Chinese government basically moved its head of their central bank to the head of the pension fund. So that's putting them out to retire. And that's because they brought him on because they knew he was a market reformer, and he got the one thing they wanted, that now the Chinese yuan is part of the reserve currencies in the world, which all that means is central banks can hold hold their monies in the yuan, will count as one of those reserve currencies. And so the environment that we're going to be in 2017 early on is going to get some more repricing of assets. That was a big event that China is not going to follow market things, so China's going to have more problems.
Mm-hmm. A lot more problems. There's going to be a lot of volatility there. And how that spills over to interest rate volatility, which I think is the greatest risk for our industry, how do secondary managers, executives that own these companies, how should they be viewing or looking at managing differently in 2017 than they did 2016 and
first
before?
Thing is, mortgage bankers need to pay attention to volatility. They need to understand that if rates drop, if where we are right now at 4.4 on mortgages, if we drop back down to 3.8 in a fairly short time period, that means you're going to be covering your hedges with short MBSs. And with short MBSs, there's margin calls now, or can be. They look at credit and all. But there's more risk of a liquidity crisis. You mentioned Bradley, W.J. Bradley, early on.
Yep.
Well, it's because they hit a liquidity crisis. Some inside things that they were doing, which took their cash off the table. And when they did that, then you had this blip, and that cash crisis put them out of business. So cash is king. And so people need to realize you can't operate a mortgage company with low cash reserves. If you do, you will go out of business in 2017. You're going to go out of business either in the first half because of the downdraft in rates, and that means margins that you'll have to reach on your mortgage-backed securities, or else you're going to be put out of business when it dramatically increases in rates from hitting the lows, whatever those lows may be, whether it's 1.9 in the 10-year, 1.6 in the 10-year, or 1.3 or even 1.1, Those numbers are possible, but because of the Trump bump, I'm only looking at 1.9 to 1.6. But if we're here at 2.4 and we drop down to 1.9 fairly quickly, or 1.6, that's a big move now. So I think the move that we've seen, that's right.
It'll be significant. And so the Trump bump, is it a speed bump that you're referring to that we're rolling over? Explain the Trump bump.
Bump was basically when he got elected, people were surprised. And then they started realizing this is going to be a pro-business government, more pro-business than it was before. And it will be pro-GDP growth. It will be with those things. And we should also see some increase in inflation. There are some concerns about what type of drag there'll be on international commerce, and that's a subject for a longer discussion. But if these things, the Trump bump took us from the below 2% in the 10-year to above 2.5 in the 10-year. That Trump bump, and also expectations now. We've got expectations of the stock market, people are really happy. We've had a bump in consumer confidence. Those are all great things. And I do think some of these things are going to come about. However, the Trump bump is now over a little while, because now it has to be, you have to get real policy passed through Congress, really get it implemented, really get it into the economy, and all of those things are going to take time. Confidence will be good, but there's going to be scary things that happen. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say consumer confidence came in, there's just been a surge in that. So we see that. That's kind of a fickle emotional index, as I refer to it. It's feeling-based, and that can change quickly, as you know. So you're saying that we're going to see the volatility, we're going to see a drop in rates in the first quarter? It'll all happen in the first quarter, and then do we start heading north?
First quarter,
starting the second quarter?
Second quarter. It could fall into the second quarter.
Yeah. It could,
I'm
so
looking
it could
at
start,
the expected end. Range. The low end of the 10-year should be hit in the first quarter. It might be spill into the second quarter, but I'm looking at 1.9 if it's calm. And so that's still a big move, even if it's
calm.
That
is a big move. Yeah, that's even if it's calm. Wow.
Right. And then if we get some of the exciting things, I think we'll get, we might get down to 1.6. If we get a lot more of it, I have not put this in my forecast, but there could easily be a significantly lower rates for a wider range downward if some of these things cascade. I'm not sure that that's going to happen. I'm not really leaning that way. I really think the 1.9 to 1.6 will probably be it for this year. But that move is going to be pretty condensed, just like the move up was condensed. The move down is going to be condensed. And people are not going to really be believing it. They're going to think, oh, no, we're in a higher rate environment. We must be because the Fed's tightening. That's sarcasm. So if we get this movement down and we have gotten some of these race to the bottom on currencies with the dollar still going higher, that's going to create some real problems on people that are hedging. But here's where the real problem lies, the big problem that will lie.
The big problem
is when it starts going the other way. So people got surprised by the Trump bump, and that was a pretty significant increase in rates. But it didn't, you know, going from 50 basis points in the mortgages, in the environment that we're in, they kind of handled it fairly well because you're not really dealing with margin calls. Here you're just dealing with, am I overhedged? And we've had a lot of people wanting to get their pipelines closed because there's concerns.
Right.
But what happens if you're down at low levels and you have a lot of these refis and then it starts taking off high? I think you're going to have some people that are overhedged in certain environments, and that it's going to happen because it's going to happen faster and farther. We're going to have some significant moves. So
well,
I do
I'm
look
getting
for the
text-
high end. The high end, 3.2 if it's an expected range, 4.1 if it's outside the range on the 10-year.
Okay.
And that should translate into the mortgage side to the high end for mortgages will be around 4.8 with a low end about 3.9. But the outside, and these outside numbers, I would not be surprised to see mortgages hit. And this would be a wide range for mortgages. 5.
Yeah, this is a wide range you're talking about.
And by the way, I'm referencing the primary mortgage market index that the Freddie Mac publishes. So the outside I see is 5.4 on the 30-year regular mortgages, and then to 3.6 on the low rate, loafer rates. I think it's probably only going to be 3.9, but it could down 3.6. If you got that extreme move even beyond what I talked about, that real extreme move, because that would mean real financial problems globally happening.
Right.
And that could happen, by the way. 3.2 is what I think.
Yeah, and I think those extremes could be realized, especially if there's a race to the bottom and there's the instability that's out there as a result of that. I think that's very plausible. So that's very interesting. So 5.4 down to a low of 3.6, and the lows
extremes
will be realized. Yeah,
those
these
are
the
extremes.
Exactly. These are extremes, 3.6 to 3.9, and we'll be realizing those in the first quarter, slightly going into the second quarter, but somewhere in the second quarter, it's rocketing up, and we're going to have all the rate increases.
Rocketing up.
I don't want to use that.
That's
term,
right. And then I think I got you sidetracked to hear a lot. Dave, sorry for that. But for the audience, I know you were wanting to ask me a question about Trump and Russia.
I do. We'll close it out with what do you there, and then also your China effect, the China effect. So go, but let's talk about Russia and Putin and how does he play into this, especially with some of the latest news that we're seeing.
Well, there's a lot of people that think, well, Putin wanted Trump elected, and that Putin loves Trump and Trump loves Putin. What it really is, and this people need to keep perspective. The reason Putin wanted Donald Trump, because he felt that Donald Trump would be good for oil prices.
Right.
The other thing, he thought that he would be better for overall global economy recovering. So if your outlook is one president versus another president, you have a choice. Which one's going to be better for me as a foreign country? Which environment's going to be better for me? Russia's in a recession, and they've been in a recession. I think it's 3% growth growth last year in 2016. Most forecasts have them still remaining below zero in GDP growth next year. 2017. They have a declining population. They've had been just really rocked hard because of the oil collapse. Russia wants to see stability in the oil markets. Now, some would say, well, Trump's going to make sure that we're producing more oil. So wouldn't that cause a problem with capacity? It could be. That would be a good counter argument. I do think that we're going to have more oil jobs. But the issue will become what type of consumption of oil you have. I think we're going to have higher consumption of oil, because if the market if the GDP starts picking up globally in the second half of the year, and you have some of the other policies that we want in place here not fully engaged, then we're still not going to have our high pickup in productivity or in high production of oil in the United States. We'll still have some. It will be growing. But it may not be as much as you think as these policies get through. And then we're going to see for Russia, they're in a really good position to pick up some of the excess. If the market starts picking up generally, global growth in the second half of the year starts to pick up, then he's a winner. His country can move on into a positive GDP, might even cause some population shifts back into Russia to service the oil economy. So that's what he's hoping for. That's why he loves Trump.
Very, very interesting. I can't believe we've been chatting here for as long as we have. We could go on and on about this. You publish a daily newsletter, an update. It's a great blog. I love it. I read it constantly. I would love to. How can people connect with you on that? What's the best way for them to?
The simplest and easiest way, Dave, is to go to Lick It on Linden. No, we have posted it there before.
Yeah, I know.
It would be go to our website, which is LoanLogix, and that's LOAN, not LONE. LOAN Logix, LOGICS.com, LoanLogix.com. You'll go to our homepage and scroll down to the bottom, and you can sign up for the newsletter. We'll say sign up for newsletters. You click on it, then you'll have a choice of a few of our blogs, and one of them will be Market Logix, and they can
Market
sign
Logix,
up there. And there's no charge for that, and we've been very happy with how why our listener or our readers just keeps expanding every year. We're very pleased with the growth of our readership, and we hope we've given people lots of things to think about. We try to be non-traditional in thinking, in the sense that I do talk about Europe, I do talk about Asia, I do talk about Africa, I talk about these other continents, I talk about other central bank policy. You can get all of the U.S. domestic stuff you want from a good IB or some of your good hedge advisors that are out there, but the facts are I'm trying to give you something that's a little different to think about each day, that how it might be impacting rates.
You do a great job. You look at your previous forecast, you going back as you did earlier in the program, all the way back to 2011, and you realize how accurate you are. This is a real interesting wide range this year. And so very fascinating.
It's really
tough.
I don't want to forecast this, but this is going to be tough. And you did mention about the hedge advisors. The hedge advisors,
yep,
really smart people, do good things. The tendency is,
yep,
they're using reactive models, which that's
right.
Okay. You can usually stick between,
yeah,
the ditches that way. But if you go out to extremes, that's when the problem happens
for
reactive risk management. That's right.
Right. That's
and
where
we're going
to
have
fall
some of
apart
those
in hurry.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And we're going to
We're going to have margin calls. We're going to see some companies go out of business. It's unfortunate.
Yep.
We don't want to. I'm not excited about that, as we're going to lose some. We're going to lose some people this year, and it's because.
But you're also going to have the companies that have adjusted or have really addressed quality within their whole systems, you know,
right,
to originate and manufacture loans with high quality, and that also are paying attention to volatility and know how to manage the risk of volatility. There's tools out there. There's methods out there you can do to manage volatility better, that are also making sure cash is king on their balance sheet. If those type of companies will flourish in this environment, top loan officers are going to be well rewarded if they're tagged with the right company, with the right type of processes, the right type of cash management, and the right type of hedge policy. If they have those three things, they're going to be very successful in 2017, because it's going to be a purchase money market.
Yep.
Strong
Boy,
purchase money market.
We could go on and on and on, and we will. We've got to have you back several times,
okay,
probably quarterly throughout this year because of this. And at least that often, and get more updates. But I want to say thank you so much. Happy New Year to you and your family and everyone there at Loan Logics. You do a great job, and I encourage you to check out the website, Loan, L-O-A-N, Logics, L-O. Come on, let's give me, I just B-I- went blank on the.
B-I-B-F, yeah. No problem.
So anyway, GICS, check them out, .com, Loan Logics, LOGICS.com. Check it out. Get signed up for Les's newsletter. Appreciate you being with us on this holiday. And whatever you are, listeners, doing for the rest of this day, I hope you will take some time to give this this exciting, somewhat sobering message as we head into the new year some real consideration. Pass it around, share it around, and be sure to get a hold of Les. I just got a couple messages already. How can I get a hold of Les Parker? What's the best way for them to connect with you with their specific questions, Les?
LoanLogics.com has my name there, my email, and they can send me an email.
It's all there, right
there. Respond to the newsletter. It goes to marketing. They always get things to me also. Either way.
Perfect. Very good. Next
and
week
happy
we got
New
more.
Year.
Happy New Year. Yes, for sure. Next week, listeners, we got Marina Walsh of the MBA joining us. We'll be talking about some of the newest MBA research. We're going to be talking about some of their projections that they've got. Can't wait to talk about origination forecasts. We're going to be armed with some extra questions. I know Marina will listen to this podcast in advance of that. So very interested to hear or have you all join in. Give us your feedback. We'll be speaking at the events coming up, the Independent Mortgage Bankers Conference. I'll be also the opening speaker at the Texas Mortgage Bankers Secondary Conference. Be sure to check that out here in Austin, Texas, at the end of this month, January. So it's good to have you with us. Have a great week, everybody, and we hope you had a Merry Christmas, but a Happy New Year. Thank you. See you back here next week. Thank you, Les. Appreciate you being here.
This has been Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lickin of Transformational Mortgage Solutions. Join us again next week, and thank you for listening.